While Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon on July 20, 1969, my guest Michael Collins was orbiting in the Apollo 11 command capsule, waiting to take Armstrong and Aldrin back to Earth. 3 years before, Collins piloted Gemini 10 and walked in space, attached to his spacecraft only by a high-tech umbilical cord. After he retired from the space program in 1970, Collins briefly worked as Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, a position he described as a plush purgatory. He felt more fulfilled in his next job as director of the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. Michael Collins has written a new book about the U.S. space program called Liftoff. His previous book, Carrying the Fire, was an autobiography that became a bestseller. I spoke with Collins from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. He has witnessed the Earth and the Moon from a perspective few others have shared. I asked him if he feels a responsibility to describe it to the rest of us.
Well, I think it's important to write those things down. I think sometime 50 years from now, people will say, I wonder what it was like now that flying in space is so routine. I wonder what it was like back then when it was not routine. How did it impress those who first went up to the moon and look back on Earth. I think it's, I'm not sure it's important, but I think it's kind of fun to write those things down.
In the very beginning of your new book, Liftoff, you describe how it feels when a technician snaps the helmet down into the neck ring. Would you describe that for us?
Well, that's when you sort of say goodbye to the world, because even though you're still on the surface, you can no longer smell or really touch or even hear something unless it's electronically piped in. So when that neck ring goes click, click and locks into place, you're hermetically sealed and your space voyage has really begun then, even though you're still standing on the ground.
Is it a good feeling or a terrible feeling?
It's neither. It's sort of like shifting gears in an automobile, I guess. I'm not sure third gear is better than a second or worse, but it's a definite break, a definite change, and you feel you're into something entirely new and different. Neither better nor worse, just different.
When you were strapped down in July of 1969, waiting to head for the moon, and you heard the countdown, what were you thinking about when you heard the countdown?
I don't like countdowns. I don't like, I think you're nervous enough without someone yelling in your ear, 10, 9, 8, 7. I think what they ought to do instead of having those backwards numbers is have someone with a sweet voice like yours, Terry, say, hey, I think it's about time to go.
Now, are you serious about that? I mean, would you really... I can't tell if that's just what you're saying or if you really think that they should change that because the countdown causes a lot of extra attention for the astronauts.
No. I'm kidding. But to be serious, I think it's totally unnecessary as far as the crew's concerned to tell them every last second preceding. I mean, we know we have a clock right there in front of us. We know pretty much when the thing is going to go. But it's a small point that either way they want to do it is fine with me.
I'm really interested in the sensation of taking off. I'm thinking just when you go up in an airplane, your ears lock. What happens to your body when you're propelled into space at this incredibly high velocity?
Well, the motors are very, very powerful, but they're lifting a gigantic weight so that when you first leave the launch pad, and you can see this on your television screen, the thing doesn't disappear instantly. It's a very slow and stately ride at the beginning. Then the thing is that the engines keep churning away at full speed. The fuel tanks begin to empty so that the weight is decreasing, the power remains the same, and then you really begin to accelerate. It's as if a giant hand were pushed down on your chest, and you find it very difficult to move. You can't really move your arms or legs very well, and even your breathing gets a little bit forced.
When you were heading toward the moon, it was Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin who were going to walk on the moon, and you were going to be in the control room circling the moon as they did their walk. Why was it you who was chosen to stay in the command capsule?
Gee, that's something that evolved over a long period of time. I became a specialist in the mothership, the command module. Aldrin had been an expert in rendezvous, and Neil Armstrong was the most experienced test pilot among our astronaut group. So these sort of specialized skills of ours, the three of us fit together nicely, but it was something that developed over a long period of time. It wasn't that all of a sudden one Friday morning someone said, you, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do that, and you're going to do the other.
When you were alone in the capsule and they had taken off, what happened? Did two capsules break apart so that they could go to the moon while you stayed where you were?
Yes, that's right. The machines were quite specialized. The one that I was in, which was called Columbia, was the base camp, you might say. And the one that made the final approach and landing was called Eagle. And it was a specialized machine, had two parts. The bottom half of it, which had the landing gear, stayed on the surface of the moon, is still there, and it acted sort of as a launch pad for the top half. The top half blasted off from the surface of the moon, came back up and found me in orbit overhead. And then we just jettisoned, left old Eagle in orbit around the moon, and the three of us came home in Columbia.
Now, you confess in your new book that your big fear when you were alone in the command capsule was that you wouldn't be able to make contact with the other astronauts and you'd have to leave without them.
Well, that's certainly true. I think a trip to the moon and back is a long and fragile chain of events. I think of it almost as a daisy chain. Any one link in that chain can break the entire sequence. But of all the links, the one that clearly to me was the most complicated and the most hazardous was the rendezvous, bringing them back up from the surface of the moon and having us meet at the proper time and place and join and go back home together.
So when you were alone, how did you occupy your mind to prevent yourself from obsessing with fear that you wouldn't be able to hook up again? Or was that not a problem?
I had a lot to do. Uh-huh. I had to get the newspaper in, put the cat out, make sure the fireplace was in good shape. I had a lot of housekeeping chores to do. The command module Columbia was a very large and complicated machine, and you have to keep paying attention to it, make sure all the temperatures, pressures, and so on are within limits, and that the thing is humming along in good shape. So that took a fair amount of my time. The rest of it, I'd have to say, I really enjoyed it. It was wonderful to have an occasional break from the constant chatter on the radio and get off behind the moon in the utter and complete silence of being the only human being on that side of that planet.
And this is the dark side, the side we don't see from Earth?
Yeah, it's the far side, the back side. Sometimes it's dark, sometimes it's light. It depends on the angle to the sun. But regardless of light or dark, it's utterly quiet, completely serene. I knew that over on the other side there were 3 billion on that funny-looking little planet out there and two on the surface of the moon. But where I was, that was all, just me.
My guest is astronaut Michael Collins. He was the command module pilot on the Apollo 11 mission when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. After leaving the space program, he was the director of the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. He's just written a new history of the U.S. space program called Liftoff. How did you know that it was going to work, that you were going to be able to meet up and return together? I mean, when was that moment when you knew this is it, we've made it, we've made it?
Well, I did not know. I was worried about it. It's the rendezvous process is a relatively straightforward one, provided everything goes exactly right. But if, for example, they don't take off from the moon on time, if they're late by a few seconds or a minute, then all kinds of bad things start happening, and you have to change your entire strategy for bringing the two vehicles together. Likewise, if their gyros, let's say, their gyroscopes were tilted a little bit and they went up into some kind of a lopsided orbit, I might be able to go get them, and I might not. I had some extra fuel on board, but it's very costly of fuel to change your orbit much, especially to change the direction of your orbit. And so there were just a lot of unknowns, in my mind at least, and therefore I was pleased beyond measure to see them coming like right down the center line of the highway below me. I could see that from my computer and from the information coming from their radar that things were going well. And as they got closer and closer, I started feeling better and better and more confident that we were going to carry the whole thing off.
You wrote that when they returned, you wanted to give Buzz a big smooch on the forehead, and then you were too embarrassed, so you just shook his hand.
Yeah, I wanted to greet him like a parent might greet an errant child who'd been out late, and you're so worried about where they are, but when they finally appear, you're just delighted. You give them a big hug.
So did you want to hear all about it when they got back in?
Yes, we had a lot of things to talk over, but not much time, because then that's a really busy period there. You have to transfer all their equipment back into the command module, get rid of Old Eagle, come swinging around the moon, and at exactly the right time, you have to ignite your rocket motor to break the bond of lunar gravity and to establish yourself on a trajectory that's going to come slicing into the Earth's atmosphere a couple of days later, slicing into the atmosphere at exactly the right angle.
You know, all of us got to see the moonwalk on television. Did you get to see any of it on a monitor while you were in space?
No, I had no I had no way of seeing what was going on. I could talk to them. I had two different ways of talking to them while they were on the surface. One was when I was overhead, I could speak to them directly for a couple of minutes, and then when I went over the horizon, their horizon, I could talk to them by relay back to Earth. I could say something to the Earth, and then my voice would be bounced back to them on the surface. For the rest of the time, when I was behind the moon, I wasn't talking to anybody, nobody there.
It was interesting to me when you came back down to Earth and you landed in the water.
Yes.
The capsule was upside down for a while.
Yes.
And you had to be careful that you didn't get sick and throw up. Because what would the dangers have been if one of you had gotten sick in the suit you were wearing?
Well, they were worried about our bringing germs back from the moon, and we were immediately put into a quarantine. First, we were in a small container aboard the aircraft carrier, and then that container was flown by airplane back to Houston, and we were put into a quarantine laboratory there. So the point was, whatever germs we brought with us, and we, in fact, brought nothing strange from the moon, but had we brought any germs with us, it was very important that we keep those germs locked up inside that suit with us, so that if we'd had to, unzip the suit and get ill, the possibility existed we might contaminate our home planet here.
Boy, it would really be a hypochondriac's delight to come back from from a moon voyage, and then imagine yourself coming down with disease no Earth person has ever even heard of yet.
Well, we thought the chances of that were extraordinarily remote. Neil used to try to explain it by saying if you multiply a very, very small number, and that is the chances of our bringing any microbes back, against a gigantically large number, and that is a consequence of infecting the planet, what do you get? I don't know. You get a finite entity that's big enough to worry about, I guess.
I want to ask you about another really momentous space accomplishment in your life, and that was in July of 1966, when you were, I think, the first person in space to leave the vehicle and make contact with another space vehicle. Is that right?
Yes, there was a spacewalk leaving Gemini number 10, and floating over to an Agena, another unmanned vehicle that had been left in orbit, and retrieving from that Agena an experiment package and then bringing it back to the Gemini. And And that was a little strange and a little bit different, and that's not something that you can quite choreograph like you can other parts of space. You just sort of have to see how it goes as it goes, and I had a few problems. I was trailing this umbilical cord, and there was there were loose pieces of metal flapping off the end of the Agena, and I was afraid that the cord was going to get entangled with the Agena, and that I was going to get wound up in a horrible mess, a ball connecting these two spacecraft. And poor old John Young, who was back in the Gemini, would have no choice but to snip my umbilical cord and leave me up there. And so it was a little tense for a while.
When you left the capsule for the spacewalk,
mm-hmm.
did you have to just kind of jump the way a lot of us jump into deep water for the very first time, thinking, well, I hope I float. This is it. Gotta go.
Well, what happened is the first time John maneuvered the Gemini under the end of the Agena, and we were about, I guess, 10 or 12 feet away from it, and I gave a little tiny nudge. I didn't want to get going too fast, and I floated up and almost missed the thing, but I barely snagged it. But then as I was going hand over hand around to where the experiment package was, I fell off. And so I had to reel myself in on the umbilical and come back into the Gemini cockpit and then try again a second time. And the second time I had, instead of just pushing off, I had a little gun, it was called, where I could squirt out nitrogen gas and propel myself. So I aimed the gun right at the tip of the Agena and started squirting gas, and then I just kind of slowly rose up out of the cockpit and floated over to it and grabbed it once again.
Wow. I really want to hear what it looked like, but before we hear that, we're going to have to take a short break. My guest is astronaut Michael Collins, and he was the command module pilot on the Apollo 11 mission when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. He's just written a history of the American space program. It's called Liftoff. We'll talk more in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. Astronaut Michael Collins is my guest, author of the new book, Liftoff, the story of America's adventure in space. Well, I think if there's any experience in the universe that could really make you think about how small each person is compared to the universe itself, it would be your experience walking in space like that. Did you think about that at the time, or were you too preoccupied to think about it?
No, actually, during that Gemini flight in Earth orbit, we were really busy. We were working about 16 to 18 hours a day, and we were overloaded. During the flight of Apollo 11 to the moon, I did have a chance to look back and give it some thought. If you look at the Earth as it is from the moon, first you find it's a tiny little thing. Once you locate it, you may look out all your spacecraft windows and not see it at all. But once you swing around and it comes into view, you're startled by how tiny it is. It's about the size of your thumbnail if you hold your arm out in front of you. And it's very, very bright, very, very shiny. The sunlight bounces off it. It's almost like a small headlight out there. Blue and white, primarily the blue of the water, the white of the clouds. You do see some land, but your primary impression is a little blue and white marble, and no sign of human beings, no sign of any habitation. The overriding impression I got was one, oddly enough, of fragility. I mean, I've walked the surface of this planet all my life. I know it's rock solid, but from space it appears to be very, very fragile. And if we think about that view, it's an accurate one. Our little planet here, with its very thin atmosphere, is a fragile entity, and it makes you want to really nurture it and protect it once you've seen it from outer space.
When you were doing your spacewalk, what could you actually see?
Oh, you can see wonderfully well. You have the whole world at your feet. Come roaring in over the Pacific Ocean, you can see in one glance all the way from Alaska to Baja California. You go across the United States in something like 6 minutes, and if you miss something, Not to worry, you'll be back again in another 90 minutes and get a second look at it. This is true when you're inside the spacecraft peering out a small porthole. It's even more true when you're outside and you got this wide-angle view of the whole world below you.
I'll tell you something I don't understand, and I don't know if you could explain it in lay terms, but when you're out dangling from this umbilical cord in space attached to a spacecraft, the spacecraft is speeding around in orbit. How do you keep up a relative speed with the spacecraft?
Oh, gee, that's hard to explain. It's sort of like driving down the highway at 55 miles an hour in your station wagon, and you've got the kids in the back seat, and If one of the kids jumps up off the seat, that kid comes down in the same spot. He doesn't come down somewhere else because the car has moved out from under him while he was up in the air. You see what I mean? The car is going 55 miles an hour. The kid's going 55 miles an hour, but the kid bounces up and down, lands in the same spot in the car because he's going 0 miles an hour relative to the car. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does, except that you're outside of the car, so to speak, at this point.
All right, make it a convertible then, instead of
right,
a station wagon.
Got it. Okay. I want to quote an astronaut who you quote in your book, Joe Kerwin. He says, "You carry with you your own body-oriented world in which up is over your head, down is below your feet, and you take this world around with you wherever you go." What does that mean to you? In space.
Well, what he's talking about is getting disoriented, where all of a sudden you say, "Whoops, I'm upside down." And there was a lot of debate, especially aboard a space station like Skylab, and that's where Joe flew. There was a lot of debate about should you make all the dials and gadgets read, which way? I mean, which way's up? But you can kind of, and what Joe is saying, well, up is not. Up as we know it here on the ground, really up means away from the center of the Earth. When you don't think about it that way, but that's really what our up is. Down is toward the center of the Earth. Up is away from the center of the Earth. And what Joe is saying, that doesn't matter so much anymore. You take your own little up-down orientation with you, and you kind of think of things relative to your own body and its position rather than where the center of the Earth happens to be.
Do you think that most astronauts who've gone as far away from their home planet as you have are changed very much by that experience? It seems like the kind of experience that would lead you to undergo either a religious conversion or to come back thinking about things in ways you've never thought about it before, or that you might be very depressed afterwards because nothing could ever measure up to the climactic experience of walking on or orbiting the moon?
Well, I think all of those elements you mentioned are certainly there, Terry. I think I can only speak for myself, and in my case, they were there. They are there, but they're not. They're relatively small things. I think I'm still fundamentally the same person that I was before I flew in space. I on the side of Union Station in Washington, D.C., there's an inscription carved in the stone that says, "He who would bring back the wealth of the Indies must carry the wealth of the Indies with him." I think you pretty much come back the same person that you went up. Some sensations, some ideas are certainly heightened. You see things that will remain with you all your life. I've been privileged to see things that that earthbound people will never see, and I won't forget those things. But I think I'm probably fundamentally the same person I was before.
Did the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger shake your confidence in the space program?
No, not at all. If someone had told me when I first entered the space program back in the 60s, that we would go for 20-some years without anyone getting killed riding a rocket, I would have told that person they were hopelessly optimistic and incredibly naive. Something like that just had to happen sooner or later. Look at that all-time favorite American gadget, the automobile. We make automobiles as safe as we can. We put a lot of sound engineering into them. We have a lot of rules and regulations about their use. We have to get them inspected for safety. We're supposed to drive them 55 miles an hour. Despite all that, we still kill 45,000 Americans every year on the highway. Now, with that as a background, how can we suddenly expect a different machine, much more powerful, much more complex, to be perfect? We really can't. I mean, I think we've asked too much of NASA, we've asked too much of the space program to judge it against a standard of perfection. People are people. They're going to make mistakes. NASA made some mistakes. We saw it in the death of seven people aboard the Challenger. But I don't know. Progress doesn't come free or easy.
What do you think the next big goal for the space program should be?
Well, I'd like to see it be Mars. I think Mars is the most fascinating place out there. I think some day, some year, some century, people will have the option of either living here or living somewhere else out in the solar system. And if you believe that, then Mars clearly is the next logical step in that direction. It's a fascinating place. It's almost a sister planet, yet it's one that's totally different from Earth. The question is, for example, at one point in its history, Mars had an abundance of water, enough water to carve out deep channels, twice as deep as the Grand Canyon. And now that water has evaporated and gone. Why? What was that process? What does it mean for the future of this planet? I mean, we're starting now to see ozone holes over the South Pole. Do you suppose once in Mars's history they went through a similar kind of thing? Why did these two planets turn out to be so different when they started out to be quite similar to each other?
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
My guest has been astronaut Michael Collins, and he piloted the command module during the Apollo 11 flight when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. Collins' new book is titled Liftoff, and it's a history of the U.S. space program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.